A listener production.
You are listening to episode 207 of the Howie Games Part B, featuring former Socceroo Mile Jednak. Do not forget tickets to see Tottenham Hotspur at the MCG versus Newcastle. All details in the show notes. See them there. Click on it. Everything you need to know. On we go. You mentioned this day you ended up in Turkey. Now, I read the name. My Turkish football's not that good. Can you please pronounce the name of the
team? Do you want to have a go?
No. Because I ended up just writing Turkey because it was G's and B's and Q's and R's.
So the proper way to say it is Gençlerbirliği.
Gençlerbirliği, which is where I've spent a bit of time
Ankara.
In Turkey. Oh, in Ankara. Hoshi, I remember a real cold period. Yeah. It get cold.
Yeah, so I signed in the January window, which is their winter.
Oh.
So I got there. It was
you
that.
Still have all this, like they were, mate, I was there in like 95 and they were, whatever they were burning to keep warm, there was just this, I love Turkey, but there was just this smog across the whole city.
So it was definitely one of those.
Freezing joint.
It was cold. We flew out straight away to Antalya, which is on the coast where they were doing a mini sort of preseason. So that was my first experience of it.
You were with your girlfriend?
She was my fiance. But she didn't go over at the start.
Okay.
Not when I signed and all that. I had sort of literally got signed on the dotted line, went to Antalya, done sort of the mini preseason, back to Ankara. We started the season again and then.
Did you start?
Yeah, I played, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I played. Straight in the team.
So when you get off a plane, right? This is, again, that fascinates me. You get off a plane, you go to a club where I presume your Turkish is not that flash?
Yeah, no. I didn't know a word.
Okay, so that's not that flash.
Yeah.
So got to find somewhere to live, new food, new team, new teammates. Like, football's football, but how do you go on the first day? Do you, like, you go in and shake everyone's hand and introduce yourself, or do you sort of sit in the back row, like you don't want to sit in the staff, you know, striker's seat and all that type of stuff?
You have to. You have to go and do that. You're there to do it. You're there to do a job. You're there to make an impression. First and foremost, can they get a glimpse into me a little bit around how I am as a person? Never mind the football. They'll get to see that, no problem. But as a person, and I was fortunate enough at that time because there was two young Australians that were already there at the time, Bruce Gitte and James Troisi.
Oh, yep.
So those boys were already there. They had 6 months ahead of me. So they sort of caught me up on that. I was obviously a little bit older than them. So again, but they were brilliant. Like I said, having the boys there was great for the settling in period. Then when my wife came over, James had his family there. So his parents were there and his younger brother, and they sort of helped with her.
Yep.
And sort of showed her what they do and how they do things. And again, for me, I could just focus on what I needed to do, and ultimately that's what I did. And we had a great time.
Tell me an experience that you had playing Turkish football that would surprise me and people listening here, where you think, oh yeah, I found myself at this ground, or this happened, or
I got stories. There's stories. We could probably, like you said, we could probably spend a couple of hours and go through them all. But I remember one game. So just to put a bit of context onto this story. So when I signed for the team, they were struggling. It was a, you know, relegation dogfight, as they call it, the terminology. And we were playing so we had a good few games at the start. We won a couple of games, which was like we had won the World Cup. The celebrations and stuff. But then we went a few months into it, we went to another rival basically that was in that same scrap. So none the wiser, I'm sitting on the team coach. We're going to the game, and I've got the old, you know, the headphone. Everyone wears the headphones, the noise cancelling ones, and I've got them on, listening to a bit of music. And all of a sudden, I see people sort of jumping out the way from the right hand side over to the left hand of the thing, and I'm like, what's going on? Pop the earphones down. Doof, doof, doof. There were opposition fans throwing big like boulders at the team
coach
just to try and intimidate.
See,
but mind you, we went to we had like an escort and stuff. Like we had a, always had a, the security was, you know, unrivaled. It was we had an escort to go to the games, but you'd see, and I caught him. I opened the curtain. I looked, and I'm like, kids, and they're just running, like they're just running down the track, and so then you turn up to this game, and obviously how hostile, you can imagine the hostility. And
well, I can't, like, what is the all I can remember the shots of the unsuccessful, unfortunately, Socceroos getting off the plane and going to the hotel in Uruguay. Yeah, right. I remember seeing that and thinking, so is it like
that?
Yeah,
there's there. I mean, it's like that. I guess from that perspective, there's obviously booing and noises and whistling. And again, depending, there's some horror stories from Turkey. Not that I ever experienced that, but there are, depending on which teams play each other, like some of that rivalry beforehand can be very, very destructive. Not pleasant to be around, but that was something where you're like, I think we ended up drawing the game, which was good for us at that time. But it was one of them where you're thinking, well, you're jumping over. And they're like, oh, there's, you know, rocks and boulders and stuff getting thrown.
So you end up at Crystal Palace. This is a good chance to talk about how this type of thing happens. Because again, Ange explained it to me about how as a coach, and you have someone looking after you, how does it happen is it called an agent? You call them an agent? And the decision-making process to get offered an opportunity, and then as a footballer, do you then have to look at where you're going to fit in that potential team and whether you're going to play? Like, how does all that work? Well, you're in Turkey and then there's an opportunity to go to Crystal Palace. Like, does the phone ring and you – how's it work?
Yeah, the phone rings. You have a couple of conversations with – I think at the time, Tony Popovich was at Crystal Palace.
Okay.
So as the assistant, he had just got there, and we had a conversation. Then we had a conversation with an agent, someone that we both know. And then that sort of conversation started to happen. First of all, would you be interested? Obviously, I knew where they were. They were in the championship. Obviously, I got aspirations to keep pushing on and try and get to the highest level. So I had teammates in the Socceroos and that were playing at the top level, and I thought, oh, yeah. But then you get, you know, brought back down to earth and you're like, well, this is, you know, there's a path to this. And then we come over and explore the opportunity. We met with the manager at the time, Dougie Friedman, who's the sporting director there at the moment.
And what type of guarantees or non-guarantees do they give? Do they set out, we think, right, Emile, we've got a weakness where you play, we can see you playing here, or is it just, mate, turn up and give it your best shot and we'll see how you go?
Yeah, probably more the latter, but not like that. But I think they obviously do their homework, right? So Tony would have known, he knew about me obviously through the national team and stuff, but they would have alerted the manager, and then they would have done their own research on that. And that's how the conversation was sparked. The agent at the time mentioned me to them, and he was like, oh, it just sparked something in them, and they go, oh, okay, let's explore this. And so then you sit down and you speak about what the potential plans might be, not necessarily for you as an individual, but the team. Again, ultimately, that's how you pitch it. You're pitching it to the team. I remember we were sat in a hotel in London, and it was myself, the agent at the time, me and my wife. My wife was pregnant. And Dougie, the manager at the time, goes to us. He goes, we'll get you into this hospital and blah, blah, we'll take care of it all and blah, blah, blah. And so anyway, we end up signing. We end up signing the contract, and funnily enough, this clause is in the contract, and you're like, okay. And then we end up having our first son, and we don't stop hearing about this bloody hospital bill from these like afterwards, not in the immediate time, right. But we start, because again, they offered it, and you're like, well.
So that was part of the contract?
Well, they had offered it.
Right,
so you're
absolutely.
Like, well, okay, if that's what you want to do, then they were like more than happy to offer it. And I'm like, well, okay.
What, and the bill got a bit higher than was expected?
Well, I think by their accounts, a little bit. I guess my wife had a cesarean, so again, she had to stay in there and whatnot.
Well, the hospital probably looked at it right. Crystal Palace was paying the bill. Yeah, it's probably a weekend. So okay, on the grubby topic of money, okay, and well, it's not grubby for you guys because it's all public knowledge. Your salaries are public knowledge. Do you go in with a financial hope or request from your agent, or how does all that work? Like, what you're going to get paid? Or is the club just says, right, mate, this is what you're going to get paid?
No, it's a negotiation.
Okay,
it's
a negotiation.
Yeah, it's a negotiation. Okay. But again, it's always market value. What is the club paying? What are they they paying their top earners? What are they paying? What's the bottom? Where do you fit in all of that? And not stuff that you particularly get involved in, but the agent sort of relays that message. Sometimes he makes a decision on where he thinks you'll be pitched at. And
what type of clip does the agent take?
It depends. Sometimes they get, most of the time they'll get something from the club that's for arranging the deal and things like that. I know that's how it's worked previously.
What will be the top wage generally at Crystal Palace at that stage?
I don't know. In the Championship,
yeah,
£12,000 a week.
A week? It's not bad, is it? Okay, so that's for your top liner. Okay.
I'd imagine something like that.
Righto. I used to work in England. I used to work on the F1 car racing, and the boys had an expression, if you got a pay rise, are you on footballers' wages yet? Or not? That was the expression, footballers' wages. Okay, Crystal Palace in the Football League Championship, so one below the English Premier League for those that are tuning in. So you became captain, and then you became captain of the Socceroos. You became captain in a lot of places you played. You're going to find this, I'm picking you a pretty modest man, you're going to find this difficult to answer me, but do your best. Why have managers selected you as captain?
They've obviously seen something that they like. They think that's reflective of what their team should be like. They obviously seen someone that was invested in the team. And had his own standards.
Yep.
And knew how to maybe articulate that and communicate that with his peers as well.
That's a great answer.
On the pitch. And through sheer experience, through sheer listening, I used to love being around different groups. And I remember my first times at the Socceroos and, you know, speaking to and seeing observing some of the guys I looked up to watching. And seeing them and being around them and picking their brains for a bit of knowledge and, you know, whether that be in a training session or at a meal time. And again, it's not that you didn't sort of mimic or copy that. It was more, right, what's the behavior and then your own interpretation of that, right, until you go through that. And that's sort of how, I guess, and then you try and do it through behaviours. For me, it's always behaviour. You got to, if you're going to talk the talk, then you need to be able to do what you're saying. And I used to, that was my thing. It was, you know, by example. And I was fortunate enough to be able to do that for a number of years.
From the outside looking in, you always seem to be the ultimate team man. You look to be a bloke that would sacrifice what he had to do to help the team in every single.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I think sometimes at the cost of my own well-being in terms of playing and stuff like that, you go through little niggles and, some key matches I remember that, you know, you played with basically one leg and you do it for the team and you felt it afterwards. But for the sacrifice of what you were going to maybe potentially achieve or what you were going to win, then it was a small sacrifice.
I want to ask you about a few different games in your career now, both in the UK and then obviously for the Socceroos. Firstly, Crystal Palace in the 12-13 season. The most bizarre thing is I hadn't gone back to what your early career is. You rolling without a beard just looked.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And a big head of hair. A
lot of hair.
A mop.
A good bouffant, I would describe it. Mm. This is pre-beard. You look very different pre-beard. You look young. So that one of the great things about football is promotion and relegation. And I still don't think we understand here what it means. But the final day of the 12-13 season, so you need to secure a playoff place. So 1 and 2 go directly up to the EPL. 3, 4, 5, and 6 go into the playoffs to get a spot in the EPL. So you need to secure a playoff place in this final game against Peterborough.
Only a win will guarantee Crystal Palace a place in the playoffs. The same 3 points will also retain Peterborough's status in the Championship. It's a classic finale, brimming with possibilities in a division that's been full of intrigue since the opening day back in August.
And you scored.
Yeah.
What is a moment like that like before we get to the actual playoff?
I think like that. I remember the day quite vividly. Didn't start well. We didn't particularly, you know, there was a bit of, we hadn't had a particularly good run in to the end of the season.
He lost quite a few games on the trot, I think.
We did, and we were sort of, I think the term would be stumbling our way into the thing after a really fantastic, like.
So you were dropping down the ladder.
We were, our form wasn't the best.
Okay.
And we were holding on in certain aspects, but we had a few results, and then we came to that last game, and you know, we go down, we come back, we go down again. So we're losing 2-1 and we score. Kevin Phillips scores a great goal, 2-2, that roof's off, like a point's enough because the other results are going our way, and we're secure. We were secure with a point anyway. And then we get a free kick towards the end of the game, and I got my big Buffon, as you said, onto the ball, and
yeah, I reckon you just clipped your
score,
hair.
Score the goal.
Palace 2, Peterborough 2.
The strange thing about that game was it was a real hard one because we won and we knew where we were going, but they had got relegated that day as a result of that goal. And I got one of who became my teammate, was in that team as well at the time, and I just think to myself, wow, like, well, obviously we were on a thing, but you almost felt like, wow, these have just been relegated on the back of this. You realise that afterwards and you're like, yeah, really a real surreal moment. But I was just happy that we won and we got a little bit of momentum back.
Added time is almost up. Peterborough need a goal. They're not going to find one. Crystal Palace will go into the playoffs. Of that there is no doubt. But Darren Ferguson's Peterborough United are going into League One.
So then you go into the playoffs. So you finish fifth. You knock over Brighton and Hal Obion 2-0 on aggregate. But then you have to play Crystal Palace versus Watford in front of 82,000 people at Wembley. And the first thing on the highlights of this, I watched 15 minutes of highlights on YouTube. First thing I'll make, the commentator comes up and says, so for people to understand, this is to go into the English Premier League. The first thing he says,
how much the game's worth.
It's the first thing he says, this game could be worth £120 million to the football club that wins it. And that got my attention, Millet.
The most lucrative match in world club football. Victory could be worth £120 million through promotion to the Premier League and visits to the likes of Manchester United.
It's the biggest game it's the richest game in football.
The richest game in football.
Yeah, it's gone up, I think, now since then. 10 years inflation and...
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. So tell me about the game which went to extra time before your man Phillips delivered.
A man whose career started at Watford in 1994... who's been beaten in two playoff finals, will take the penalty and scores. Crystal Palace 1, Watford 0.
Yeah, it should have probably been won by us in normal time. We had a number of opportunities, but again, and obviously everyone knows what Wembley is, and any football fan knows, you know, all the FA Cup
finals. What is
it
like on a day like that?
Unbelievable.
Is it? What's unbelievable about it?
Sea of red and blue that we had at the time with Palace, their fans were off the charts. They were never sort of outsung. From my experiences at Wembley with them, they were never sort of outsung. And
what are they sing for Palace? Like, what type of stuff they go with?
Oh, they just go hard the whole time. Just noise, pure noise. And
they have a song for you?
They've got, what did they have a song? They had a song for me.
Go on.
They had a song for me.
Come on. How's it go? Come on.
You're testing me.
No, come on. As if you're, mate, there's blokes singing songs about you. You must
testing
know.
Me. They had the, what was it? Who was it? Casey and the Sunshine Band?
Right.
No, 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 no. And then it was my name and that's how it was.
Mila, yeah, da, na,
yeah,
da,
that,
na,
that's
na,
how it was, yeah. Na. Got, yeah, so you could finish it. You could have done it for me. There you go.
You're better.
So that was the one I used to get there. And but again, the Wembley game was
Palace leading 1-0. Almunia's gone forward for it. He'll get a second chance. No, he won't. Crystal Palace are in the Premier League, and it's Palace who go up, and Watford who cry in despair. Crystal Palace 1. Watford 0.
You look at that moment and you think, wow, like, I knew what was at stake. I knew what it meant, what it would have meant to everybody. And yeah, I sort of, yeah, that was the sort of overriding emotion was, wow, this is going to be life-changing. This is where I wanted to try and end up, is in the Premier League, and I've did it with Crystal Palace, doing it this way. We've got promoted, and being a part of that was extra special with the sort of group we had at that time and what we had been through. Again, it made it more special.
Such a mix of players in your squad. How can this happen against some of the better moneyed, more fancied teams?
Look, one thing we do have, not saying that they don't, but we've got a lot of team spirit. These boys have showed that all year, character, I say it a lot, and that's what makes this team so strong. And, you know, we all did it for each other today, and it's just, it's incredible.
What does it mean? What does it mean to the diehard fans? Like, you must have had people come up to you, I'm sure you still do now, on the streets of London saying, mate, I'm a Crystal Palace man, and I saw what you did and what it meant to me and my family and the generations of support of this footy club. Like, I think you'd been out of the EPL for top flight for 8 years or something at that point.
Yeah, and as a result now, they've not come out.
No.
And they hadn't survived previously before that. So I think that sits well with me at the moment. It always has done, because we were part of that team that was able to keep them in the Premier League, where ultimately we felt we belonged at that time. And, you know, they've gone on and, they've gone on and been now stalwarts for a number of years now. I think it's their 11th season this year. So, again, on the back of that stuff, when you were the guys to sort of make that step, because it is hard, it's not straightforward. It wasn't even straightforward that season. But to be able to do that, like you said, you get in the street, and people will always say, and again, you just remember it with fondness. It's a big smile on the face for sure.
Back to Millais momentarily. You have heard Ange Postecoglou's name mentioned in this podcast numerous times. Big Ange, he's one of my favourite guests that's been on the show. He first joined the show way back on episode 12 when he told us about his first coaching job.
You know, when I went to Paran High School, and really we were an afterthought, the soccer team, and then the music teacher was assigned our coach. And I remember the first training session, you know, we had a couple of balls from last year and a couple of cones, and we started playing, and then the teacher sat down under the trees and started marking the homework for tomorrow. I go,
this is the coach?
Yeah, it was supposed coach. I go, no, that's not going to do. I said, I'll take charge here. And as a 12-year-old, I literally became the coach of the team. I set up training, I set up the team and how we were going to play. And I guess part of me goes, what was in me at that time to feel that I felt comfortable in the space? But even more bizarre for me is that my mates, who are still, some of them are still mates today, actually listened to me. I'm going, because in a social sense, I wasn't the leader, you know, in the playground. I was just one of the kids. But when it came out, they just said, you just seemed like you knew what you were talking about, so we just did it. And, it kind of was the start of the coaching career.
That was episode 12. Then, later on episode 165, Ange joined us when he was coaching Celtic.
And again, I've just closed the computer and I've just gone, what the hell's going on, mate?
I love this.
Because this is Celtic, yeah? This is one of the biggest, most famous football clubs in the world, a club that I'd known as a kid that people have talked to me about. You know, I know what nights at Celtic Park are like. They sing You Never Walk Alone. It's one of the most famous football clubs in the world, and here I am, and potentially I could end up being the manager of this football club. So again, Georgia's coming. She's going, now she's, you know, her head's rattling. She's going, what's going on? I go, I think they're going to offer me the job. I don't understand it, but I think that's going to happen. I said, I'm sure Frank will call us.
That is Ange Postecoglou on episode 12 and episode 165 of the podcast. Might need to see if we can get him on for a third time. First time we would have had a guest on three times. I reckon it's worth pursuing. Let's get back to Millais. Socceroos.
Jedinak drives it. Millais Jedinak is the goal scoring hero again for Australia.
There's Brillante with the free kick for the Roos. Oh, nobody picked up Millais Jedinak. Clean as a whistle, back of the net. If you don't mind, Australia lead 2-0. The skipper leads the way and they're singing in the rain in Melbourne.
Yeah, three World Cups. 2010, 2014 as captain, 2018 as captain. South Africa, Brazil, and then obviously 2018. What's a World Cup like as a footballer? Well, this is a footballer that wasn't getting a start for Central Coast and then you're rolling out as captain. Is it as much as we see, you know?
It's what is it? It's for me at the World Cups were, yeah, they were dreams come true from a, you know, you talk about that playoff game and what that meant from a national team perspective, watching the national team not qualify for a number of years.
Yeah, heartbreaking.
Being around and in sort of, you know, on the and seeing that firsthand, what it meant, and then seeing the boys qualify in 2005 and what it meant again to the to us as football fans, then the boys go and produce what they did in Germany, which was again outstanding. The support, the level. Part of this, like this is thing. And so I remember on the back of the, you know, going into the 2010, again, someone who was on the periphery, I'd say, as a squad member and, you know, a squad of 30 gets picked and then it gets trimmed down to 23. And when you sort of realise.
How is that when, like, is that Pim at that stage?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Does he tell you individually before or is it a team announcement?
It usually tends to be the guys that miss out get told individually, which is quite full on.
Oh.
I only know that because I've had those conversations with my teammates previously in the World Cups after that.
Yep.
Being the captain, because I thought that's the right thing to do.
What do you say? That's a really good topic. So
they've obviously been informed. So they've had a conversation with the manager and they've been with you this whole journey, right?
And all the qualifiers, all the.
And yeah, and some of them would have been around it. So for me, the biggest thing I can do, and it's not easy, they're not easy conversations, but you have to show gratitude and you have to show an appreciation for that person because regardless of what their match minutes, they've been part of something that's ultimately got us to this point now and their contribution has been significant. And I won't have anyone say to me that it hasn't been, whether they're the first camp or the last camp. That's 100 camps or one camp. Like you've got to this point, which is amazing, unfortunately, but we need to go and represent you and you're just as a part of this as anyone. And a lot of the times, like if it was someone younger or like your time will come, keep at it, keep persistent. You have to give them that hope.
So the World Cups themselves, from the three that you played in, the one that stands out is the Dutch game and Timmy Cahill's goal. But you've scored numerous times in World Cups. I think, have you scored three?
I've scored three penalties. At the two different World Cups. Yeah.
Okay.
In Porto Alegre, converts for the spot. It's 2-1 Australia. They keep on believing.
They're back in it. Game on again in Kazan.
Jedinak looked absolutely certain before he took it.
So this is because when I read about you, it's like this man doesn't miss penalties. So that's why they keep putting you up. So you're obviously very good at that. Tell me about the pressure of going to the penalty spot in a World Cup match and how you would work your way through it, Milo.
Well, the Dutch game that you're mentioning there, the Holland one, was, again, my first experience of having to do that for the national team in the World Cup, right? So you don't know how you're going to respond would be my honesty. But we had a solid game up until that point. We were – so you were feeling – well, we were feeling – like I was feeling, obviously feeling confident. And the honesty is I didn't really think about where I was in that moment because, again – my sole focus was what I had to do.
Do you have a process to?
Yeah, I think. Like,
what's your process?
When you step away from it and you look at it, it's like, well, I know what I want to do. I've got to go and grab the ball and spot the ball, no problem. I'm going to focus on what I've got to do, go through the sort of routine. Not that it's anything, you know, out of this world, but again, for me, it was very much right. Pick your spot, clean contact. If he goes the right way, make sure it's hard enough that he doesn't think. Now, that always doesn't come to fruition, but I just thought I'm going to go here. And for that one particularly, my mind was made up before I'd even shot. So I went. The ones after that, though, that wasn't the case because I'm 4 years down the line. Goalkeepers have probably seen me take all sorts of penalties. So they know a little bit more about me as well. So again, you play that, you know, you go through that again, you go through a similar routine. And then I guess with me, it was particularly for those two, the last two, running up to the ball. And I wouldn't say the first one, even the first one against France, but the Denmark one, definitely, like, he goes slightly early and then you can see him in your periphery. So you just play it to the side of him. And that's not typically the way I wanted to shoot. I like to always go across myself to the left.
Yes.
But he left it open and I thought, well, I'll take the opportunity then.
And what is it like scoring in a World Cup?
Oh, it's amazing.
Is it?
It's amazing. I think for me, I hate saying it, but no, I hate saying it. I don't hate saying it because it is what it is. I had people there in the stadium for me, my family. I lived their dreams through what I just did. And they were there to support me, but you're given back to them in those moments. But then what you then realize is you've also given back to all the other Australians that are watching there. And then you start seeing the viral videos of people in wherever they're watching the games afterwards. Cause my sister would like send them through, or people would send them through to me. And I'm like, wow, like, this is incredible. I'd love to keep scoring.
2015 Asian Cup.
Australia with the lion's share of support up against South Korea. Two inspirational players from the Premier League. Milay Jedinak with Crystal Palace and Ki Sung-yung with Swansea City. And they have been key in guiding their nations to this decider.
South Korea, who'd beaten you in the pool matches. Luongo scores 45.
Oh, lovely little turn from Luongo! Oh, what a goal from Massimo Luongo!
Then Sun scores in injury time.
Here's a go, right through the middle. Sun Heung-min for South Korea in stoppage time!
And then Tommy Yurik, the ball's dead. Like, the ball looks dead. And to me, that is an Australian football side never giving up. And he just battled. He was on his bum. And it was like the Korean bloke gave up.
Option from Mackay. Juric in a wide area. Going for goal from out there. Going to win it back off Kim Jin-soo. Big man, Tommy Juric. Fans want a whistle. Not going to get it. Still in play. And risky play. And there might be a tap in here. There is. Australia go in front. James Troisi. Is the Johnny on the spot?
What's your memories of that, the ensuing goal, and being the first Australian captain to hold up a major trophy in football? That's a rather big question.
It's good. It's a good question. I think from my perspective there, it was, you know, we played them in the group. I didn't play in that game. I got injured in the tournament.
Yeah, that's why we didn't win, mate. I wrote that down. No Milay, no Socceroos.
And then you go through that, the final comes around, and then, you know, you've got to deal with that bit of a setback when Sonny scores in the last minute.
Oh.
They've got all the energy, and to be fair to Korea that day, they were outstanding on the day. And again, we get back to that, and then I remember at the end of full-time huddle and the boss is speaking.
Ange.
He's speaking about...
What's he saying?
He's going, it's only going to make this story even better. Like, forget it. Like, you know, a typical thing, as he was, you know, as he is, he gives you that extra bit of, right, we're good here. We're fine. Like, there's nothing, you know, when the whole stadium was nervous, as you know, you can sense that, you can get that sense.
I remember throwing stuff at the telly when they score in injury time.
That's what I mean. You would do, right? You probably would have, you could have done more than that. You could have ripped your TV off the wall. But we just had this calmness, believe it or not, we had this calmness, and we to that moment, and we score. And I was on my last legs. I had that ankle injury hadn't healed up, and I was like, I remember going up for a ball, and I felt like, oh my god, I'm on my leg here. But I just remember the full time whistle going. I was just like relieved. I was just like, wow, we've done it. And on top of that, like, what my motivation was at the time, obviously the team and everything and wanting to do it, but I had bloody 80 people in the stands for me. And I'm like, they're not going home disappointed here tonight. Huh. This moment's not come this night, and then we're going to go home disappointed. We need this needs to be a celebration for everyone. And yeah, we done it, and it was incredible. I mean, it was amazing to be to be able to do that and to experience. I guess it's always with those things. The tournament itself was fantastic, and that 2 weeks, but there'd been a build up of that since even that World Cup in Brazil. Like, it was just that period to get to that point. And then, like I said, we took care of the business then, and then we sort of kept sort of progressing as a team.
Out to the right, but it's over. Australia has done it. The Socceroos, kings of the continent for the first time. They're the champions of Asia in 2015. What a night in Sydney.
We always finish this the same way. And you're a father, so you'll understand the weight of this question. Mille, you've been brilliant with your time. Can't wait to see you out here for Global Football Week with Tottenham. Again, you can see all the details and the links, how you get tickets, how you can see Tottenham in action, Newcastle United, Arsenal as well, the women's squad, Matildas will be playing throughout it. For all those kids that listen to this show, and we're lucky we have a lot, on the way to football practice or guitar practice or math study, or whatever they want to do with their lives. You've had a lot of success. What advice would you give to those youngsters out there that hope to achieve success in their field?
Keep dreaming big, and don't let anyone ever tell you not to, because, yeah, I've lived it to a certain degree, and you can achieve anything if you put your mind to it.
Mate, thanks for coming on. It's a treat to have a chat with you. I can remember a lot of those games. I remember that Asian Cup final and you holding up that trophy. It still sits with me. So, mate, good luck. Travel safe. Enjoy your time with your family back up in Sydney, and we'll see you out here in Melbourne soon.
Beautiful. Thank you very much.
Well done. Thanks to Mille. I don't know about you, but I reckon he'll be coaching the Socceroos at some stage down the track. Good luck to him. Alrighty, that's all I've got for you this week. Until next time with Susie O'Neill, peace and love.
And we can do it if we try, try, try. If we try, try, try. If we try, try, try.